Time to take a look at your pet's health. Hi, everybody. Larry Mueller here. My guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. And if you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join us. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question, a comment, or even a photo of your pet right there. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It's nice to be here on this beautiful day. And you know what? Who else is enjoying this beautiful day?
Who?
Ticks.
Oh!
We have been picking ticks off of dogs left and right the last few days. And, you know, everybody forgets that, you know, they think, oh, we can wait until spring. Well, you know, ticks, they're hiding under that leaf litter and they're just waiting for this beautiful weather to come out. So if you haven't started using flea and tick stuff on your pet, you need to.
Okay, well, what about guinea pigs? Would you need it for guinea pigs?
Well, that's a good question because guinea pigs probably shouldn't be outside.
No.
You know, there's too much temperature fluctuations and so on, but it is Adopt a Guinea Pig Month. And so I thought, what a great way to promote guinea pigs is to bring it up on your show. My daughter used to have a guinea pig and he lived to be 7.5, 8 years of age and died of kidney failure. Wonderful pet. And, you know, but I just want people to know there is no such thing as a low maintenance pet.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's just you find a pet that fits what you can provide for it. And, you know, the big thing with guinea pigs is you don't want just one. You really need to have a group, at least two. They love company. They have very specialized dietary needs. A lot of guinea pigs, believe it or not, are kind of like us in that they need vitamin C. And so you have to have special guinea pig pellets that are enriched with vitamin C. If not, they get scurvy. You know, they need to be kept clean and dry. They need cuddle time. They need play time. You know, they are a lot of work, but you know,
they're
fun and they're a nice size pet for you. They can be a little messy at times, but, I don't think they're really good for little kids, but you know, when my daughter got hers, she was 8 or 9 and, you know, and that worked out, you know,
up until she was about 15 then.
Well, almost until she graduated from high school. So,
Well, that's great. So it's a good idea. And why are there, are there a lot of guinea pigs out there?
There are. And the shelters have lots of them. So instead of going to a pet store, check out the local shelters because there's lots of adoptable ones there. And there are guinea pig rescue organizations as well that you can find online. But the reason why I think a lot of them are out there is people think that they're low maintenance pets. And they realize when they get them home that they do need to, they are work. And so kids, you know, parents get it thinking the kid's going to take care of it. And they lose interest, and unfortunately, the guinea pig loses out. So you always got to do your research before you adopt a pet in your house.
Well, like many people, actually, obesity in pets can cause a lot of problems.
Yeah.
In fact, our own cat, Tiger,
I know,
is on his weight reduction program right now.
You know, it's really interesting that there is a couple things that have come up recently. One was a study where it was the owner's perception of body shape. And they asked owners to grade their pet's body size on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being too thin, a little bit thin, 3 being normal, 4 being a little overweight, and 5 being very overweight. And guess what? Men tended to be worse than women with underestimating their pet size. So instead of being like it was an overweight pet, they said it was normal. And so more than women. So I think maybe women have a little bit better body perception of themselves maybe. And so they maybe look at that with their pet. But I think it's important for, you know, when a veterinarian tells you your pet's carrying extra weight, to not be saying, they're full of it. You know, they look just like the dog next door. Your veterinarian is trained to be able to assess body condition. But you're right. We have lots of issues with health problems. And maybe as the show goes on, we can bring up some of those health problems and some of my tips for weight loss.
Well, Tiger's on a reduced diet. He seems to be doing fine with it. I was surprised.
Yeah.
I thought he'd be whiny, but
well, he's got a playmate and your daughter as well. So he's got lots of activity. And sometimes we substitute food for attention, and that's probably the biggest reason why pets gain weight is giving them you know, giving in to them instead of meow, and when they meow, instead of playing with them, we feed them. Or we say, hey, you want a treat, and we give them a treat. So a lot of it's obesity is a human problem. It's not a pet problem. So it's the humans are the ones that end up causing it.
We have a caller who wanted to know where you get your tick remover and what tick remover you use.
Well, you can just actually go online and just Google tick removers, and you'll see a whole bunch of them coming up. The ones that I like, there's a couple of them on the market. Mine's just called the tick remover, and I think I got it at Gander Mountain one time when I was in there. There's one that just looks like a little measuring spoon with a notch cut out of it. Mine is a little metal piece that's kind of about the length of my pointer finger with a notch cut out of one end, so you can just slide it under the tick. The ones that really are difficult to use because you squish the tick's body are anything that look like tweezers, because we tend to jerk them out. And remember, ticks will actually cement their heads in. So it's better to use something that you actually are kind of prying them out or pushing them out rather than jerking them out, where you can break the head off and then that can cause some irritation.
Well, we have callers online to visit with you. Let's go to Arlene in New Berlin. Hi, Arlene. Oops, let me get you on here. Can't get her on. Well, we're having a little trouble with that. I know there's some research, before we go to the phones, I know there's some research on happiness for dogs that lose excess weight.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
And that is one of the things that I wanted to talk about as well, because, you know, when we have, if you've got a pet that's overweight, they tend to be more arthritic, they're grumpier, they may be in pain. There's all kinds of things that go along with it. And we actually see them being more aggressive, they're decreased, you know, they're not as sociable. And they just don't enjoy life as much because they can't get up and move as easily. So there was a study that was done at the University of Liverpool over in the United Kingdom.
Yep.
where they looked at 50 dogs and they had them go on a weight loss diet and until they reached their ideal weight. So big range in amount of weight loss. On average, dogs lost about 25% of their body weight.
Uh-huh.
It would be like us, you know, losing a quarter of our body weight, but that's what these dogs needed to lose. And there was actually a couple in the study that lost 44% of their body weight. I mean, they were like almost half the size that they were. And what they ended up doing is they had the owners fill out questionnaires before and during and after this weight loss. And definitely these dogs were happier, more social, more interactive with family members, less pain, less aggression. So, you know, it really does make
all the way around there.
It wins, and the dogs are going to live longer. A dog that is a normal body weight or on the thin side is going to have a longer life expectancy. So, real important to get working. Now that it's springtime, get your dogs out there, but start your exercise program gradually, or you'll have the weekend warrior syndrome with them being sore on Monday.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to, I am having trouble for some reason. I'm having problems with my phone system here. So we'll see. Let's see if I can get this thing working. Well.
Technology, you know? I have exactly the same problem at home.
Oh, well, yeah. Everybody, hold on. We'll probably get we'll get somebody in here and we'll get this fixed. In the meantime, let's talk a little bit more about eating and food with pets. And I know there's some folks assume that a home-prepared diet for a pet is always better than a store-bought one.
Yeah, and the reason why I brought this up is we just had an owner in who's got an elderly dog who's in kidney failure that really needs to be on a specialized diet. And there was a study that was just published in the American Veterinary Medical Association's journal, this month's journal, looking at an evaluation of recipes for home-prepared diets. And this was just for dogs and cats that had chronic kidney disease. So a fairly specialized diet. When we have a pet with kidney disease, we need a diet that's low in salt, low in protein, higher in potassium, lower in phosphorus. So very kind of unique nutritional needs. And they looked at 67 published home recipe diets for dogs and cats that for chronic kidney disease. And what they found was that most of them, almost all of them, were nutritionally inadequate. And so it's really hard to trust these recipes. if you're going to want to do a home-cooked recipe, especially for a dog with nutritional, specialized nutritional needs, I'd work with a veterinary nutritionist. Unfortunately, we don't have one at the UW Vet School.
Oh.
So we refer a lot of our patients to, like, UC Davis has a nutritionist there. And, you know, they actually have a side business called balanceit.com. There's several others. And, in fact, you can go to there's a website for the College of Veterinary Nutritionists that you can actually find who's in your area, if there is anybody, and who would be able to help you with that. So if you want to do home prepared, you know, don't just trust something you're going to read online. Work with a veterinarian.
Well, let's try and see if we can get people online here again. Bob in Madison, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good.
Thanks for getting me on, Larry.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for calling.
I don't have a question about nutrition. I have a question about how dogs taste. You know, sometimes I have a nice chicken breast jerky, you know, and I'll break it up into smaller pieces and give it to my dog, thinking that he's going to enjoy it that way better because he has to have time to taste it instead of just swallow it.
Well, dogs and cats have taste buds. And, you know, you've kind of caught me a little off guard. I can tell you that cats don't taste sweet. Our taste buds that taste sweet, cats don't have. And so there's, you know, they are tweaked a little bit differently. Cats tend to prefer more acidic foods. Dogs, I'm drawing a blank at actually the differences between dogs and that would be a good thing for me to look up and maybe bring back on the next show. But what's the difference between dogs and people? I know that, you know, dogs do have different taste preferences. To give you an example, one of my dogs absolutely loves plain Greek yogurt. And so if I have just a little bit left in the bottom of a container, she'll be in heaven until that thing goes to the recycle bin. Yet my male dog, he actually will make a face, like a disgust look, like, ugh, you want me to eat that? So, you know, there are, you know, even within the same species, different taste preferences. This problem with dogs gulping their food and not enjoying it, I mean, it's just part of their biology. I mean, they are an animal that's a predator. I mean, they were a predator. I mean, my dogs couldn't prey on anything right now, being bulldogs. But, you know, they were predators at one point. And so they would have to, you know, catch things and eat them fast before another predator came in and stole their dinner that they worked so hard for. And, you know, and even sometimes the way we raise our dogs, you take your typical, you know, large litter of Labrador Retriever puppies and, you know, the breeder will put down one big bowl of food and you've got these dogs that are all rushing in and going, I got to eat enough. Or, if, you know, if I don't eat enough, then I'm going to be hungry.
Yeah.
And so it teaches them to be really competitive and to eat fast. And I think I've brought this up on the show before, but even in my own home, when I grew up, kind of whoever finished dinner first got first pick of dessert. So what did that train me to do?
Eat fast
and crave sweets. Okay. So, and it persists even now. And that was, you know, back how many years ago, the way I was raised. And I could have a leisurely meal, but boy, I'm one that just rarely tastes my food. I just down it. So, yeah. So good question. I will look up what dogs actually taste and get back next month.
Next month. Great. Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Steve in Eau Claire next. Steve, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Great, great. Yeah, I know what you mean about ticks. I mean, I've been dealing with ticks here in Eau Claire for the last 3 or 4 weeks. Both my dogs have had the ticks. It's really kind of surprising when you find one crawling around in your bed and you have them attached to you because the dogs brought them in. But that's not why I called. I have a Shih Tzu pug mix, and he is a constant barker. I have tried everything I can think of. I've tried yelling at him. I've tried distracting him. Especially when we take him to the dog park, he constantly barks at the other dogs, not to be angry with them, but he wants to play. He wants to run with them. But when he's running, he's constantly barking. And I'm just trying to understand what his psychology is, because he is
yeah,
a strange dog that way.
Well, I mean, dogs at dog parks that are kind of those nuisance barkers are definitely kind of frowned at. People are like, why is your dog being so noisy?
Noisy, yeah.
One thing that you mentioned is that you tried yelling at him. definitely don't do that. I mean, that is one of the things that probably reinforces the barking. So your dog is barking, and what do? You yell. Your dog barks louder, you yell louder. And so it becomes a big bark fest, and the dog just thinks this is the perfect way to perform, is just to keep barking because you keep barking back. When we're training a dog to not bark, there's kind of a couple of approaches. One is there's got to be a time where your dog takes a breath, where your dog is quiet. That is the time you need to reward your dog. And so reinforce the good behavior, not the bad behavior. And even punishment is still going to reinforce it because the dog is getting attention from you. The other way to approach it would be there are some devices on the market that you can use. Mine favorite one is one that's called the Citronella Bark Collar. It doesn't work for all dogs. And in fact, if they've got a lot of hair on their neck, it may not work very well. So, you know, your dog having some Shih Tzu in it, it may have a fairly long, I don't know how you keep the coat. But what it does is when the dog barks, it releases a spray of citronella past the dog's face. And so they hear it, see it, smell it, feel it, and they don't like it. But not all dogs. Some dogs, they don't even care. They'll just bark right through it. And so then you're back to the drawing board of, you know, reinforcing the quiet behavior and teaching your dog an alternative behavior to barking, such as sitting. It's really hard to get a good bark out when your fanny's on the ground. So, you know, work on some of that obedience. I'm a little hesitant to recommend things like shock collars. That's kind of the extreme. And boy, you have to be so careful with using those things. But I think the Citronella collar would be one that potentially could work for your dog. And they've really come down in price. Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And more callers online. We'll get to them in just a minute. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, as we take a look at your pet's health. She is a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine with us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today. I wanted to mention before we get back to questions that on Thursday, April 5th, I will be hosting the second annual WPR Listener Dinner. It'll be at Milwaukee's Mitchell Park Domes. Really a great place. I'll be doing a mock garden talk show with Milwaukee gardening guru Melinda Myers. Great chance to meet not only me, but our other WPR hosts. Kathleen Dunn, Ben Marins will be there, WPR Milwaukee Bureau reporter Chuck Quirnbach. So I hope you'll join us for great food, great music, the lovely greenery of the domes, and a lot of fun with WPR staff and listeners. And to learn more, go to www.wpr.org/Larry Mueller, and that's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. That's to learn more. Go to WPR.org/Larry Mueller. Deadline to register is coming up. It's March 21st. So not a lot of time yet. So get signed up. All right. And Arlene, we're going to try.
Good morning.
Hi, Arlene.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Sandy.
Thanks for being patient. Yeah.
That's okay. You know, when you're retired, you can be as patient as you want. Yeah. The reason I'm calling is I have a miniature poodle, and he gets fed. He's a grazer. He's not one that gulps his food down. He will take his food. He'll take a bit at a time, and he goes into the living room and chews it up and then goes back to the bowl. I don't know why that's happened, but that's what has mm-hmm. happened. But a couple of weeks ago, I had him to the groomer, and she noticed that he had starting of a hemorrhoid. Now, he gets plenty of water. He gets dry dog food, and I don't know if it's because his stool is hard. What can I do to soften that stool so that it isn't so hard on him? Yeah. The doctor said that he has a problem with his anal glands.
Yeah, too. Yeah. Well, I'm surprised that you mentioned hemorrhoid because we don't see those in dogs. We can get things like a prolapsed rectum from straining where it actually everts, and that's, you know, pretty serious stuff if that happens. probably the most common thing we'll see is impacted anal glands. And sometimes those anal glands will become infected and we can get some swelling and irritation back there. Sometimes they'll even burst and rupture and you'll have a draining hole kind of on one side or the other of the rectum. You know, anal glands are one of those things where there really isn't a whole lot we can do dietarily to help them. Sometimes dogs bulking up their stool with, you know, a little extra pumpkin or bran or anything that's going to add some extra fiber may help make the stools hold more water and be a little bulky. But just there are some dogs, especially as they get older, where that secretion in those anal glands are it becomes thicker than it should be. It normally is like a watery consistency, but for some dogs, it becomes very thick and pasty. And so no matter what you do with the fecal material, there's not enough passive pressure on those glands as they defecate to get them emptied. And so I have patients where they have to come in every 4 to 6 to 8 weeks for a, you know, a rectal exam and to get their anal glands expressed. And for some dogs, it, depending on their age and how much it bothers them, we sometimes even think about surgical removal. It is a procedure that is very commonly done, but, you know, it is a general anesthetic procedure.
I have another question, too. He hops on one knee, or one leg, it's his right one.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, and the groomer said to me, well, big dogs have hip problems, small dogs have knee problems. Would it be advantageous for me to have an x-ray done on that knee?
Well, your groomer is playing veterinarian and is right to a degree, but not necessarily. Small dogs can still have hip problems.
Oh.
They may just be a little different than what large dogs get. Large breed dogs tend to get hip dysplasia, but even some small breed dogs can develop hip dysplasia, like little corgis. We see hip dysplasia in corgis. The type of hip problem that small dogs get, there's a vascular problem to the femoral head that's called leg Perthes disease. Actually, humans get it as well, where it becomes very deformed and we need to have surgery done to remove the femoral head. So they can have hip problems. But if your dog is walking normally and then all of a sudden gets a little hop in their gait and then they're back to being normal again, yeah, then most likely, being a small breed dog, my thought is that your dog probably has what's called a luxating patella or a loose kneecap. Some small breed dogs, it's just they're blessed with having the anatomy in their knee is such that kneecap just slides all over the place. And depending on the severity, it's graded on a scale of 1 to 4, with 4 being like where it's permanently out. If it's just an intermittent thing and the dog is not showing any signs of discomfort, just an intermittent little hitch in their gait, probably surgery isn't indicated. But things that you should probably do to prevent it from getting worse would be keeping your pet lean. You don't want them to be overweight. So really watch that free choice feeding, because having that, you know, 24-hour buffet open could lead to being overweight.
But he doesn't, I mean, I give him just a little bit. He gets a 3/4 in the morning and 3/4 in the evening.
Well, good, good. So you're actually measuring it out. So good.
Yes.
And then, you know, watching the jumping, because jumping up and down and things is going to put a lot of strain on those knees that have that kneecap sliding in and out and stretching those ligaments. And then talking to your veterinarian about having your pet go on a joint supplement, a glucosamine chondroitin sulfate supplement, similar to what people would take, but they do have dog versions available. And again, talk with your veterinarian. There's so many of these supplements out there, you don't know what you're going to be getting. There's very little regulation, so you need to find a brand that your veterinarian trusts.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. I appreciate the call. And Jim in Oregon, we turn to you next. Hi there, Jim.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
Great. Thanks for calling. Right. What's on your mind?
My grand dog has torn her ACL. I wasn't there when she was examined, but my daughter and son-in-law have been given two choices to take care of the tear. One has got an 85% cure rate or outcome. Another one is 99%. The one that's 99% involves fishing line, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about $2,700 to have that procedure done.
Yeah, there's what you're talking about is a torn anterior cruciate ligament, and in the knee there are two ligaments that cross. That's why they're called cruciate ligaments. And this one one of them ruptures, and it allows the knee to kind of slide back and forth. And as a result, it results in the dog being very painful. They get arthritis in their knee. They end up having the cartilage gets damaged. And it's something that without surgery, they end up having a knee that's pretty useless, and they're going to be in a lot of pain throughout their life. So surgery is something that needs to be done. And there are a number of different techniques. And I've been a veterinarian long enough that I have seen it go from one to another, and every few years there seems to be the hot new technique. And it comes down to that it's going to be based on the skill of the surgeon. Ask how many they've done, because, you want something that you don't want your dog to be the guinea pig and the first one that the surgeon's done. It sometimes is based on the size of the dog. Sometimes smaller dogs that have an anterior cruciate tear can get by with some of the more simpler surgeries than the larger dogs. But knee surgery, yeah, I spent $3,000 on my dog's knee. He jumped off my pier and landed wrong and ruptured his cruciate. And I knew it as soon as he was, hobbling up from the shore, what happened, and kind of ruined a nice trip to Canada. But, that's pretty much the going rate, if not more. I mean, you may find that it may be more, depending on the technique that's used, but lots of rehab is needed afterwards, so make sure you budget for that. Your veterinarian should be able to refer you to a rehab specialist for that works with dogs. So, yeah.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. And let's go to Mona in Appleton next. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a Himalayan cat. She's around 15 years old, and she's kind of an ornery cat. She likes to be pet on her terms and that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my problem with her is combing her. I can comb her enough she doesn't mat, because she doesn't mat real easy. I posted a picture on your page just now.
Okay.
We'll take a look.
She's looking right now, and she's about to go through her heavy shed, which she does in spring, even though she's strictly indoors. Well, what happens is she gets so sick, because I can't comb her every day and comb her enough, she gets so sick where she just about gets blockage. And if I let it go too long, she'll end up, really, I had to bring her an emergency vet. I think I got caution stickers all over her chart, because she was just like a rabid animal.
And we don't take it personally. I mean, it's because they're fearful, and that is their response to just being in a situation where she's scared.
Pretty kitty.
She's beautiful, a little flame point.
What scares me about her, I have to take her in. What it always comes down to is I try shaving her a little myself at home, and I end up turning her into a chopped up mess, and I end up taking her in anyways. And it's not the expense so much as I have to get her gassed each time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have to sedate her with gas. Is how dangerous, is that going to do anything to her organs long term?
Well, anytime we're anesthetizing a patient, whether it's for something like a grooming or, a more involved surgical procedure, a 15-year-old animal should probably have some basic lab work done. And I would expect that your veterinarian's probably monitoring kidney values and so on, and attempting to do a physical exam beforehand if they can. There are some cats where we just can't even get near. We do our physical exam once they're asleep. I found that for many cats, we can groom them with, instead of using gas anesthetics, where they have to be intubated and it's a lot more involved, is using just an injectable sedatives. And there's different combinations that our anesthesia department will use in older cats that they can recover from fairly quickly. So I'm not sure what technique your veterinarian's using for administering a gas anesthetic. I know there are some vets that will, put them in an aquarium and I just find that can be pretty stressful for the cat. So ask your vet about using something injectable instead. And if they have questions regarding what they can use, our anesthesia department at the vet school is very open to doing consultations with veterinarians. And they could call and say, you know, I've got this 15-year-old Himalayan that's just crazy. What could I use that would, you know, just be a quick injection that's going to calm this cat down so that we can get our, you know, grooming done? And they'll probably be able to help you.
And the other thing, too, I'm wondering, because I'd like to avoid getting her shaved if I could.
Mm-hmm.
I can't not even do that anymore. I've tried brushes, combs. If soon as it starts pulling just a little bit, that's when she gets crazy with me.
Yeah.
If she's in a mood where she's laying there, she'll be purring when I comb her with something that's gentle. I've tried those rubber end ones.
Yeah.
But they don't take out hardly any hair.
Right, right. And with a thick hair coat like that, she's her own worst enemy. And unfortunately, you know, you've got a kitty that is a high maintenance cat that needs to be able to be flipped in one way or the other and under the armpits and between the legs and so on. And you're just not able to do it. So having her have a lion clip, although it may not look as pretty.
I have them shave everything, tail yep. right down to the tip, or she still gets sick.
Yeah, yeah. I think that she's probably happier for it. So yeah, getting her clipped is probably in her best interest.
Thanks for calling, Mona, and thanks for sending that photo. I hope people go to our page and take a look at it. It's a really pretty kitty.
I'll post the good cat, the one that's friendly.
Okay, thanks.
Link's Point Berman. He's awesome. He'll lay there and lift his arms for me. He's
thanks, Mona. Appreciate it. And a nice listener. Oh, they're all nice. Bill in Sturgeon Bay, I bet, is next. Let's go to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're sure. Welcome.
I have approximately a 13-year-old cat who is, not more than like a family member. She's my only family that I have left.
Okay. Right.
And I had her taken in. She had a problem acting a little goofy a couple of weeks ago, and I had her taken in, and we did another blood test. We do a blood test every year. It's getting more expensive, and I just can't really handle much more. But
mm-hmm.
I got it checked out, and her bun count was just a little bit lower than it was last year. You probably don't have all those numbers in front of you, but it was a 33. It's supposed to be between 14 and 36.
Mm-hmm.
So this year is lower, but the creatinine, is that how you say it, creatinine?
Yep.
That was a tad high, but just 1 point. I don't want to say just, but you know, it wasn't like alarming, but that was 2.5, where I guess the guideline is 0.6 to 2.4.
That's, but I'm going to direct you to a website. Our lab has an issue with what we call our reference intervals. So what you're describing with your cat, the two values you've mentioned are both kidney values.
Right.
BUN stands for blood urea nitrogen. So
right.
It's the nitrogenous waste products from breaking down protein. And creatinine is another waste product. And we can see BUN is one of those things that can go up and down with things like if you're dehydrated, it may go high, or if you've got some gastrointestinal bleeding, it can go high. But the one that we really look at probably most carefully when we're assessing kidney disease is that second value you mentioned called creatinine. And there's a website that I go to, I'm not kidding, probably two or three times a week, and it's called IRIS. It stands for the International Renal Interest Society, and it's a consortium of veterinarians that are interested in kidney disease, and they've come up with kind of grading systems for levels of renal disease, and there's a lot of great information there, not only for veterinarians, but also for owners. And back to, you know, this issue with reference intervals, our lab has our reference interval as the creatinine being normal up to 2.2. If you talk to, renal specialists, kidney specialists in the veterinary world, we look at anything over 1.6 as being abnormal. And so even though that is listed as normal in your veterinarian, from your veterinarian's lab, for a cat, 2.5 is putting your cat in stage 2 or 3 chronic renal failure. I don't know. That's why I have to always go back and look at that site
sure.
all the time. But it lets me know that This will be a kitty that probably should be on a specialized diet, needs to have her blood pressure monitored frequently, be on the lookout for things like kidney renal infections, bladder infections, with the dilute urine, much more hands-on when we start getting up into those, you know, kind of higher levels of kidney disease. So go to that site, refer your veterinarian to it. And I'm sorry to say, don't fool yourself into thinking that the creatinine isn't very high, because it is high. And I'd be, making sure that your cat gets some extra special care for those kidneys.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Bill. Appreciate it. Jeanette in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning, Larry and Sandy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, Sandy. You mentioned ticks right away at the beginning of the hour, and I was noticing ticks on my dog on Sunday. And the question I have is, she has 7 one-week-old puppies.
Ooh.
And she's a lab, and I didn't know, should I put her on frontline? Can she still nurse with that?
You really have to, and I would be doing exactly the same thing. It's like, this doesn't come up very often for me to say, I've read the label and I've memorized it and I know it. But yeah, frontline is generally considered very safe, mm-hmm. although it is not labeled for use in one-week-old puppies.
Okay.
It does stay on the skin. It doesn't go in the body and pass through the milk. But because it's on the skin, it's going to also be on the nipple area and in areas where the puppies are going to be, laying and nursing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that of all the flea and tick products out there, that is probably one of that is going to probably be the safest for use with new puppies.
Okay.
But I would read the package insert. You may even go to the Mariel website and look through it and just see about their, and they may even have an 800 number on there where you can call and say, hey, can I put this on my dog? I would think that probably, I know it's safe for pregnant dogs,
mm-hmm.
And it's safe for like 8 week puppies and up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that 1 week old puppy. I don't know. And
okay.
I think, if you are going to be using something, I would separate her for a few hours from the puppies.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's going to be hard on the puppies and her until that spot is dry. Or consider, if you put it on her back, maybe put a T-shirt on her that is, still allows the puppies to be able to get in and nurse, but where they can't have direct contact with the chemical.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Is there anything else you recommend as far as, I know, those frontline and those things kill the ticks, but they don't repel them?
Yeah.
Is there anything to repel them, or do we just need to be diligent about checking her and checking the puppies?
Yeah, there actually is frontline has come out with a new product that is, right now it's Frontline Plus, and instead of calling it Frontline Plus Plus, they have renamed it CertiFect. And what it is it's fipronil, the same ingredients as in Frontline Plus, with an insect growth regulator for fleas called methoprene. But it also has a tinge of another chemical called ametraz. And ametraz makes the ticks move through the hair coat rather than just stay still and start feeding. And so they tend to pick up more of the chemical and die faster. The amount of ametraz that's in there is not enough to kill ticks. It just makes them be a little more active. It's still the frontline or the fipronil that is killing ticks. Now, a good question about using that is the ametraz that's in there safe for one-week-old puppies? And I don't know. I'd have to go to the label and start having a look and see, too. So,
okay.
It's a good question, and I wish I could, say I could help you, but I'd just be careful with whatever you use and make sure you do your research.
So, okay.
Right. Yeah. Good luck.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest today, Dave Potratz, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In early July, I'll be leading a group of WPR listeners to London to tour England Gardens and attend the Hampton Court Flower Show. And we'll visit some of England's great churches and houses along with their gardens. We'll see the cathedrals at Leeds and Canterbury, visit the famous White Garden of Sackville West, and Bateman's House, which was the wooded retreat of Rudyard Kipling. Plus, we're going to spend an entire day exploring the grounds and exhibits at the Hampton Court Flower Show. It's the world's largest flower show run by the Royal Horticultural Society, also getting a private tour of the Secret Gardens of London, which will be pretty cool too. And those are just a few of the highlights. I hope you'll check out our itinerary at wpr.org/travel. We're partnering with Earthbound Expeditions for this trip. They do a lot of work with public radio stations. They really do a wonderful job. And I hope you'll consider joining us for this trip. It's a great way to meet some other WPR listeners. I'll be there to spend a little time with me and have a great time traveling. It'll be an adventure. And it's a small group, too. We're going to make it, keep it small, so it can be personal. So if you want to check it out, just go to wpr.org/travel. It's going to be a lot of fun, July 1st through the 9th.
Can you hide me in your suitcase?
I tell you, it's really going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it. And we got quite a few signed up already, but there's still a few spots, so we want to get them all filled. We have Dennis and LaCrosse for Dr. Sandy here, so let's go there. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 13-month-old German Shepherd, and I play what I call all-out frisbee with him. He's fully dedicated. He will leap in the air, roll, run until he drops and his tongue is hanging on the ground. And then I also will run him with what's called a scooter joring or urban mushing thing, where it's a bungee cord connected to a scooter.
Okay.
And what I'm wondering is, I almost do this on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And is that healthy, or should I do like humans do and day on, day off, day on, day off?
Well, dogs are working animals, and I'd have to, you know, actually probably evaluate your dog to see if there are any problems. Things that I'd be looking for would be excessive wear to the pads, especially running on hard surfaces. I'd be a tinge concerned about, you know, the jumping and twisting if your dog has, you know, anything in its, you know, family tree of having bad hips or knees. So, you know, be looking back and see if there's anybody, you know, grandparents or litter mates or anything that have had any issues that way. But it sounds like you're giving your dog a really good life. And as long as your dog isn't overheating, is comfortable when they get home, are not getting up and being stiff and sore and having to kind of work out their muscles when, you know, they get up in the morning, I'd say stay with what you're doing. And it's great that you're such a dedicated owner to provide your dog with that kind of exercise,
because
many owners don't do that.
Yep.
Well, I have to be frank. I enjoy the frisbee as much as he does.
Okay.
And the scootering.
And really watch, because frisbees can be quite damaging to teeth. And okay. So there are, you know, frisbees that are, you know, the normal, like, plastic ones and so on that people, like, that we would use and throw around. Dogs put holes in it, and then there's some, like, more durable frisbees for dogs. But, boy, I've seen dogs come in with just flattened canine teeth from having that frisbee going in and out and in and out. So,
I use a frisbee called Kong.
Okay.
And it's very soft and durable, and as far as I can tell, it's not hurting his teeth.
Good,
at all.
Good. No, so just keep an eye on that. Yeah. All right.
Okay. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Well, I was a good owner. I was doing the right things with his pet, as a lot of our listeners do, for sure. Susan emailed us, our cat Adele comes home smelling of gas and oil fumes, some mixture of gas and oil. Where she goes, no one knows. Is this harmful to her to lick off her coat?
Whoa. Well, no, I would not let her lick, because if she's obviously been around something, some engine of some kind, I'd be concerned, is she climbing into an engine and is she going to get caught in a fan belt or something for, you know, if she happens to be under there keeping warm. You know, if there's oil and fuel, there may also be antifreeze, and the cat just takes very, very little to put a cat into kidney failure with that. So, if she comes home smelling like that, I'd probably, you know, give her a bath. Hopefully you've got good health insurance. So, and her nails are trimmed so that you won't get injured, but I'd, you know, give her a bath and try to get whatever residue's on there off of her coat before she grooms it off.
Someone else wondered if bird suet is dangerous to pets.
Well, it's fat, and it can go rancid if it's been hanging out there. And there's a possibility if it's been contaminated with bird droppings, there may be salmonella or E. coli. And so, you know, and it's also, because it's fat, it can be really hard on the GI tract. Having that load of fat go through, depending on how much they eat, can affect the pancreas and the intestinal tract. And so it may make the dog quite ill. So I'd try to keep your dog away from the suet.
Okay. Sandy, someone else wanted you to repeat the website that you mentioned for cats.
The website for kidney failure is not just for cats, but it's for cats and dogs. And it's the International Renal Interest Society. And if you just Google IRIS, IRIS / kidney, it's the first one that comes up. And they talk about diet and blood pressure and, you know, what to be monitoring and the different values and when to be, you know, a little more alarmed. So that I think an educated owner is the best thing we can have for these diseases that go on for years and years. And cats with kidney disease with the right management can have a very, very long life that's very pleasant as well.
Absolutely. Kathy in Hammond, turning to you now. Thank you for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. Sandy, I just live for your appearances on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I have a couple of comments. One about cats and then a question for you about guinea pigs.
Okay.
The lady with the matted cat, about 15 years ago, I taught myself mobile grooming and became kind of an expert with cats.
Okay.
I wrote a little booklet called Grooming Secrets Your Cat Won't Tell You.
Okay.
And I discovered a few ways to groom cats without terrifying them. The difference between grooming dogs and cats is that dogs have that under the skin. Their skin's attached to a layer of muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And in cats, it isn't. And, you know, any cat owner knows that their skin just kind of glides over their body.
It's very elastic, crazy. Yes. Yeah. And and because of that, it's really easy. If you're using scissors or clippers incorrectly, you can lacerate their skin quite easily, which is you've pretty much, you know, shot yourself then in the foot for grooming again. So they're not going to sit still for it.
Yeah, and that's probably why that lady's cat does get grouchy, because it's painful for them, you know, to have the comb going through the matted hair. But I was going to ask you about guinea pigs. If you could talk a little bit about what kind of fresh foods to give guinea pigs. And then also, I have a rescue guinea pig that is about 5 years old, and she has developed over the last year a tumor, like a little mammary tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And about the size of a walnut.
Okay.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, you said a guinea pig with a mammary tumor? Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, just because it's a guinea pig doesn't mean it doesn't need veterinary care. And having her go to a veterinarian that is comfortable with working with, I mean, I hate to call them pocket pets, because you'd pick a pretty big pocket to hold a guinea pig. But having that looked at, it definitely could be a mammary tumor, but it could also be, cystic changes or something like that. We do surgery on guinea pigs frequently at the veterinary school. If your veterinarian is not comfortable with working with guinea pigs, ask them, you know, who in your area, you know, does specialize in working with these little guys, because they do require, like, you know, specialized anesthesia and so on to be able to have these procedures done. And then your other question regarding what to feed guinea pigs.
Fresh foods.
Fresh foods, yeah. I mean, I think the big thing is that they do need fresh pellets. Okay, so don't go out if you have a couple of guinea pigs and buy 100 pounds of pellets. Vitamin C has a very short shelf life. And so the pellets are going to be probably one of their one source of food. But make sure it's fresh. It's not outdated. So buy small quantities at a time. And I would not be buying pellets at a pet store from a bulk bin, because you have no idea when they were put in there. Timothy hay or, you know, alfalfa, that kind of thing, or grass, or not alfalfa, but a grass hay would be fine too. And then you can also supplement with some, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, but it has to be, that's supplementing, you know, a little, you know, some carrot or, you know, a little piece of apple or, you know, anything like that would be fine. But the majority of their diet needs to come from either, you know, grass hay or, you know, as well as these pellets.
There you go. Thank you very much, Kathy. Nancy in Sparta, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I have two beagles who used to be able to go with me for walks off leash. I would usually go for an hour in some public land somewhere. And they would go away from me, but they would come back to the car when we were done after a reasonable length of time. And lately, they have been staying away for hours at a time.
Having fun, yeah.
Oh, you bet. And once it was on our own next to our own property, they were out there for 8 hours running, and we could hear them the entire time,
mm-hmm.
but we couldn't catch them.
Yeah, this is a real problem for the breed. Yeah,
right. And I'm wondering, is there any other choice, or are there any things I can do to not have to keep them tied up for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think the little phrase that I like to have people remember is that if you can't control the dog, control the environment. So fenced-in areas, fenced-in dog parks, at least you would have the ability to, have your dog confined to a small area, but you still need to be working on that recall. Having the dog come when you call it. And so you really have to, that has to be something that becomes top priority, that when, as soon as you, whistle, call the dog, they turn and look at you and come to you. And for many people that have had dogs that run away, they have used punishment. The dog comes back to you and you yell at the dog and they're like, well, why should I bother coming back to you whenever I do come back, I just get yelled at. So you need to make coming back to you a pleasant activity. So I have people work on it where they, when the dog is out playing, you have them come to you, they get a piece of chicken, go play again. And so coming to you is a wonderful thing because they get something and it's not the end of play. So work that way where, you're using a reward for coming back to you in a controlled environment before you attempt letting them out again. Mm-hmm. You need to have that good recall.
And if they're in sight, sometimes it's Dr. Patricia McConnell says, run the other way.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes
clap your hands, run the other way. They'll chase you.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if beagles would because they're probably going after whatever animal they're smelling, but they might. Yeah,
they might. Thanks for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She's with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are important to you and you want to keep them healthy and want to keep them happy. Of course, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here for the next half hour to share new information and some timely advice. And you might be a lifelong pet owner, or maybe you're adopting a companion for the very first time. I know Sandy's ready to answer your questions about your pet's health. When you call us, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show for updates, news, and photos. If you click like while you're there, we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. And right now, we've got some great pictures that people have sent in with the pictures of their pets, especially their cats. So go to the page and stay with us for news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She comes by once a month to talk with us. Great to have her here, and thank you for listening in. Questions for her, give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you could go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. Love to hear from you. And Paul in Marinette has a question for you, Sandy, so let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me. I have a Jack Russell Terrier. He's about 7 years old. Actually, I have two Jack Russell Terriers. I also have a female who is about 8 years old. And she's the dominant one. He's the lesser dominant one. I was just wondering if maybe he has, some kind of bipolar disorder or something like that.
Why do you think that?
Well, you can be just sitting on the couch, and he's on another couch on the other side of the room, just sleeping there. And you're just sitting there, and then all of a sudden he just kind of perks up, snarls at you, snaps at you, and then just walks away.
Huh.
Very strange. I mean, he, if he's playing with a toy, I have no problem going up and grabbing it from him. You know, he'll play tug of war. If I say drop it, he'll drop it.
Good.
You know, those kind of things. But he just has these strange moments. It's almost like he's cranky.
Yeah.
You know, in a way. I know the woman who boards them also, she had a moment this weekend with him where her husband went out to give him a bath. He didn't want anything to do with that husband.
Yeah.
Back a little later, he was fine. Lovey-dovey, and everything was great.
Yeah. You know, sometimes we can have dogs that are real controlling, and it's possible that, you know, it just things have to be on his terms when he wants things, you know, and so it may just be kind of his personality that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also worry that, you know, if the episodes at home are associated with sleeping and he's, you know, people will say, well, he's up on the sofa, he's in a kind of controlling position, you know, maybe, you know, that's what's going on. But as a veterinarian and not a behaviorist, when I hear a dog waking up from a dead sleep with nothing changing in the room, like the other dog hasn't walked in, he's not, there's nothing else happening, and he just
right.
wakes up and has this like burst of being aggressive, and then it goes back to being his normal self again. There are some seizure disorders that can present that way. And and so sometimes, you know, we do see when dogs are sleeping, their brainwave pattern changes and they're more predisposed to having seizures. That's why a lot of, you know, we tend to get most of our emergency calls with seizures in the middle of the night. So I'm wondering if there might be something like that going on where it could potentially be, you know, just a kind of a behavioral type seizure. But it could just be that he's a Jack Russell terrorist and you know, and it's just, you know, he wakes up and he's like, hey, this is my couch, stay away from it, and is, you know, resource guarding. And, you know, it may just be that that's just what he's doing. So
there are occasional moments when he is sleeping, he'll start yipping while he's sleeping.
And that's pretty normal. A lot of dogs will dream and actually vocalize a little bit. You know, but where we draw the line is when they're moving so much that they're like, you know, moving across the floor, but paddling their feet a little bit and making that quiet bark and so on. He's probably just dreaming about chasing bunnies.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much, Paul, for calling. Chris in Verona, on to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two pet rats, females. They're about a year and a half old, and one of them weighs 11 and a half ounces, the other 13 and a half ounces.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how much I should be feeding them and what I can do to ensure that the skinnier one is getting enough food.
Yeah, this is true for just about any type of pets that you have housed together, is you have to feed them as individuals. I mean, people that have multiple cats, as Larry's found out, you know, you can have one that's slender and one that's overweight. And so, you know, expecting that you can just have food down and they can both, you know, just eat willy-nilly, you know, so if the one that's slender is a healthy slender, though, is not, you know, underweight, it may just be genetics where, you know, just like my sister and I, we're different sizes and shapes, and yet we came from the same mother. It may just be genetics. But, you know, if you're finding that they're one of them is like guarding the food or is, you know, being really assertive or pushy with the other rat, then, you know, taking her outside and giving her some, you know, private time where she can have access to, you know, some highly palatable food and maybe get some little extra attention that way may help. So really, I mean, I wouldn't worry about it unless there is actually a health concern because of her weight.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Beverly in Rushford, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. I have a Jack Russell also. And I've had her since she was very, very small. And she is 11 years old this April. And she's had her teeth done and everything because she is the most voracious eater that you have ever witnessed.
Mm-hmm.
She weighs about 14 pounds now.
Okay.
She's just gained 1 full pound in 2 months. Without anything changing, and I had it x-rayed at the vet office, and it showed that she had a mass, a liver mass, it was explained to me.
Okay.
that was showing on the digital x-ray. Now, they said that surgery would just find out what was on the other side of the liver mass. And but I'm wondering, with a ultrasound, whether or not that would be the best step next.
Well, that's what I would be recommending. You know, the x-ray is helpful, but you can't get a good idea of the, you know, the true size, where, you know, how much normal tissue's left, whether it's just a single solitary mass or whether there are other lumps and bumps elsewhere in the abdomen that would make you think that this is something malignant. There is a liver mass that we can see that's called a hepatoma, which is a benign liver mass. They can get very large and can affect the dog's weight and so on, but they are, you know, it can be surgically resected and the dog can go on to lead a normal life. So when we go in and we do an ultrasound and have a look and see, it's easy to do a needle biopsy where you actually put a needle into the mass via the ultrasound, so you're guiding it in and collecting some of the material. You can also do liver biopsies where you can take bigger pieces. It's a little more problematic because the liver is involved with making clotting factors, and if you take a big chunk out, you know, just through the ultrasound doing it's not even that big of a chunk, but you could run into bleeding problems. So you have to do some more testing and things prior to doing a more invasive biopsy. But a needle aspirate is a fairly safe thing to consider doing. So
What's it called again? A needle?
A needle aspirate, okay, or a needle biopsy would be what could be done. That'll help with giving some answers as well. And then I hope that your veterinarian's done some lab work as well to check the liver values, and because sometimes that can give you an idea of kind of where things are going and what may be involved. So it sounds like your vet's doing everything right by the book with recommending that as the next step.
Yeah, there you
go. They can't do the ultrasound. I have to go somewhere else.
Yeah, it's specialized equipment, and I feel pretty lucky that I have one just down the hall from me. I don't know how to use it, but I do know how to get an animal in there by setting up an appointment. And so, you know, usually for many people, it's you're looking at going to a different practice where there's someone that's skilled at running an ultrasound machine. And there's some mobile veterinarians that do it. I know I work with one of my colleagues, has a part-time business where that's what she does, is goes around with her ultrasound machine to various clinics. Then they set up appointments for her, and she shows up on a certain day, and they do it. So I'm not sure how your veterinarian does that, but I think that would definitely be worth the drive to go someplace.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for calling. And Kara in Wisconsin Rapids, on to you now. Hi, Kara.
Hi there. We have a Boxer Lab mix that we got when he was 4 years old. Four months old. He just turned a year. From the get-go, we noticed that he was bolting his food. So we got him a special dish to slow him down. But he eats everything. He's eaten a rope toy. He's eaten, you know, so we know what to take away from him. The only thing we can't stop him from doing is eating his feces and when he goes out in the yard. Our vet gave us some special sprinkles to put on his food. That didn't help. It seemed to be better over the winter. I don't know if it's because it was frozen and he couldn't find it, but I don't know if there's anything else I can put on his food that would help him stop this habit.
Not likely. This is one of these things where at certain times of a dog's life, this is a normal behavior. You look at mother dogs that are taking care of baby puppies, they eat feces. So that's hardwired into dogs to eat poop. And why does this come up at lunchtime, Larry? I don't know. But every time, okay, it's got to be a topic like this. So it's interesting that your dog doesn't like frozen poop as much as softer serve rather than you know, the harder stuff. For many dogs, it's the reverse. They like the frozen fecal material. The best thing you can do, pick it up. I'm sorry, but you need to be out there. And when your dog is out in the backyard, be right there so that they, instead of defecate, turn around and eat it, it's defecate, chase a ball, then you pick it up. The things that you can put on the food have been, I mean, unless you do it the very first time the dog eats stool, They just learn that, okay, bad season for poop, I'll try again later. And you go through your prescription and they're right back to eating it again. So there's usually not much you can try. I mean, I've had some people say that they've used a product called Prozyme, which is an enzyme product. And they just use that daily. I have a feeling that it may make the stool taste bad. It's many dogs that have this issue with eating stool, a problem called coprophagia. It is not a nutritional problem. It's not a nutritional deficit. It's nothing. There's nothing wrong with the diet. It's just the dog. And they've learned to do it. And they eat things that we find disgusting. So pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. Those are your top three things to do.
All right. There you go. We have Sandy from Wausau who emailed and says, I found out by accident that my cats love safflower oil. So I've been letting them have about a half a teaspoon every two or three days. Is this acceptable? It seems to have helped my male cat eliminate easier.
Well, I'm surprised that the male cat, it's because it's a digestible fat. You know, if you were to give them something like the Petromalt or the petroleum jelly-based products, that will loosen stool because it's not digestible, unless she's giving so much of it that it's overloading the cat's digestive system and then making them have greasy stools. But if it's, you know, is it hurting them? No, unless they have a weight issue. Is it helping? Probably not. But if they like it once in a while, sure, a little bit. But I'd be really careful because that's going to be extra calories that they don't need.
Molly in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I have a cat, and he seems to have some looser stool, or it's not hard. And every once in a while, it almost looks like he has some blood in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you had some suggestions on how to harden up that stool or what I should be doing.
Well, I think you need to get a diagnosis, first of all. What you're describing, the softer stools with frank blood, when we see frank blood, that means it's usually the colon is involved, because if they were bleeding up higher in the intestinal tract, that blood would be digested and the stools would look dark and tarry. So first thing we usually do is rule out parasites and go through some parasite testing, looking for the standard internal parasites as well as something like Giardia. Even if it's negative, we'll usually go through a therapeutic deworming. Next step would then be looking at some dietary changes. And you can go with either a low residue type diet where they produce very little stool, or sometimes we'll end up going with a hypoallergenic diet. Many cats have a condition that's called inflammatory bowel disease, where we think it's triggered by something in the diet that they're eating. And so switching to a hypoallergenic diet, it would be something you'd probably have to get from your veterinarian. And so it would be a novel protein, novel carbohydrate source. And, you know, so just going to the store and picking a new food is probably not going to make any difference. And so typically we'll use one of the products, like there's one called HA that Purina makes. There's one called ZD that Hill's makes. There's, you know, several companies that make them, and do a diet trial and see if that makes a difference as well. If that's not helping, then your next step is colonoscopy and having a look up there and biopsies, which is not fun for the cat because it's under general anesthesia, and not fun for us because we have to give the cat enemas.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's no fun. That could be no fun. Well, I haven't done it yet myself.
Oh.
Just the idea of it.
Yeah.
With our two cats. Oh, my goodness. There you have it. Thank you so much. And Bill in Black River Falls, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I've got a 9-year-old male Maltese, and he weighs about 16 pounds, and the vet wants him to lose a couple of pounds, and he's on a Hill's diet, and he eats in the morning, and then he eats in the late afternoon, but he gets so whiny around noon, we started giving him these little cuties. They're like little oranges. Are you familiar with them?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and he just goes nuts over them, and he has one a day now. How much is that going to affect that diet?
Well, I don't know the calorie content of one of those little, like, they look like a little tangerine-y type thing. Yeah,
a
mandarin orange. So that would be the first thing, is finding out how many calories are in that. So, you know, it's really a no-brainer for weight loss. It's increased exercise and decrease caloric intake, making sure that you're still having your pet on a well-balanced diet. So I wouldn't be substituting an orange for a balanced diet. So, you know, things that you could consider doing is holding back a little bit of the breakfast or dinner so that you can feed that. The oranges aren't going to hurt them, but it's going to be adding calories. And for a small dog, boy, I don't have my chart here where I can look at what the dog should weigh and how many calories they would get. But I would guess that your dog probably maybe only needs 300 to 400 calories a day. And so if one of those little things is 80 calories, that's a chunk of change for a day. And probably not providing your dog with nutrients that are going to be more helpful. And typically we like to see diets be kind of higher in protein, lower in fat and carbohydrates, kind of like our Atkins diet for people. That seems to be what works best for cats in particular and some dogs. So do your homework. Find out what the calorie content is of that.
Yep.
Okay. When we got him from a shelter, and he weighed 11 pounds and something, and he's 5 pounds over that, but I thought he was pretty skinny when we got him, but...
He may have been normal. And see, you're maybe, like I talked about at the beginning of the show, the typical guy that underestimates how much their dog should weigh. So if your veterinarian feels that, you know, that was an ideal weight. So every time I have a patient in, we do a body condition score, except from doing, we don't do it on a scale of 1 to 5. We do it on a scale of 1 to 9 and break it down even more, with 5 being normal, 9 being overweight, and 1 being too thin. And right now, I'm running at probably a little over 50% of my clientele is overweight. And so we spend a lot of time talking about obesity.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Roxanne emailed us, has a 16-year-old cat, very healthy. 2 years ago, he was diagnosed with a thyroid nodule, since been on levothyroxine, I believe. I gave him a 1 milligram every other day. Why is he yowling every so often during the day and evening, usually in a room by himself? He will yowl very loud 5 or 6 times, then stop.
Yeah. You know, a couple things that I'm kind of concerned about. Most cats that have a thyroid nodule are not hypothyroid, where they need to have a thyroid supplement, which would be the levothyroxine. That would be for a low active thyroid where you have to supplement. Typically, these kitties are hyperthyroid, where we need to use a drug that is going to lower the thyroid level in the cat to be able to bring them back to normal. So I would definitely check, because that excessive vocalization could potentially be because your cat is hyperthyroid and is not being managed correctly. So I'd check on the drugs that are being used and you know, what's going on that way. But the other reason why we'll see cats just kind of go in a room and yowl, being 16, there's a very good chance that your cat has some cognitive decline or senility.
Yeah.
Very common in cats and dogs as they get older, and that's one of the leading signs we'll see, where they just wander in a room and get lost and start vocalizing. Also possible that your cat could have some hearing loss, and they just don't have that auto inhibition where, you know, they don't hear their own voice, and so they yell a little bit louder. And so, you know, checking to see if your cat's hearing impaired, it can be a little tricky, but making a sound at a distance and see if your cat wakes up or alerts to it is, you know, a simple enough thing for you to be doing.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Karen from Sherwood emailed us. We recently adopted a cat, rescued with a local vet clinic, adopted and brought back to health. At 1 year old, she weighed 5 pounds. She's now 1.5 years old and weighs 8 pounds, but seems small and frail. Is she tiny because of being malnourished? Or is there a breed that's really tiny? She looks like a calico with short legs.
Well, we do see dwarfed cats. So they're called Munchkins. And it is a breed of cat. And they're kind of like a Basset Hound or a Dachshund. They have that same type of body shape. But it's just normal variation. It's like, you know, I have a friend that's less than 5 feet tall, and I'm 5'9", and I have a girlfriend who's 5'11", and yet, you know, we're all the same species. So it's possible, if she was very sick, that she may have been, you know, a little runted or got a little stunted in her growth. But an 8-pound female cat is a pretty average size for a female cat. So I wouldn't be too worried about it if she's healthy in every other way.
Okay. The Morris Animal Foundation is starting the Golden Retriever Lifetime Study. Do you know, about that?
Yeah, they are doing this very long study. They're going to be, first of all, targeting veterinarians. And then, you know, veterinarians are going to be looking for owners. But, you know, half of the Golden Retrievers die of cancer. It's like, we know it's genetic. And so they're actually going to be looking at enrolling about 3,000 Golden Retrievers, and they have to be under 2 years of age, have a pedigree where they can go back and look at three generations in their family, and then they're going to be watching them for the rest of their life and having blood work done and testing done and everything, and everything's going to be recorded, and we're going to start to try to find out what's going on with this breed that we're losing them all to cancer.
And so all that testing probably at no cost to the owners, then, I would expect.
Yes, right. And so watch, you know, if you've got a Golden Retriever that is under two, talk to your veterinarian. They're going to be targeting vets, and they're going to be looking for clinics to have dogs enrolled in.
Always a pleasure, Sandy. Thank you so much. And you're back?
Second Tuesday. I'm not sure.
Tuesday, April 10th, that would
be. There we go.
All right. Oh, thank you so much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, will be back with us the second Tuesday of next month, which is April 10th. So we're going to certainly look forward to that. Quick reminder, I'll be hosting the second annual WPR Listener Dinner at the Mitchell Park Domes in Milwaukee. I'll be there. You're invited. Go online to wpr.org/LarryMeeler, that's M-E-I-L-L-E-R, for more information. Deadline to register is March 21st. Thanks for listening. Phil Pelletieri joins us tomorrow on the Ideas Network.